The text of the regulation draft reads, the digital product passports will become the main tool for disclosing and sharing product information across all new and revised product legislation.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.
Welcome to the highlights of the Circular Republic Festival, Europe's leading event for advancing the circular economy, uniting corporates, startups, and innovators driving this transformation. We continue the series with a panel about the digital product passport. The panelists are Tilman Wahle, Director Sustainable Automotive and Batteries at Systemic, Pascal Köhler, Director Innovation and Marketing at IBM Pabst, and Caroline Cassignol, Expert Simulation and Digital Twin at Siemens. This panel is moderated by Susanne Kappner, co-founder of Circular Republic. But before we start, I have an offer for you. If you want to get the actionable one-pager of this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm.
Hello and welcome everyone. Thanks for being here for our session. Yes, we tried to choose a provocative title, Get Real. Do we know why we need product passports? The previous panel touched on it, so I'm looking forward to going into more depth with my panelists now. And these are Caroline Cassignol, please come on stage, expert simulation and digital twin at Siemens. She's leading the simulation and digital twins initiatives for circularity there. Your goal is to unlock insights into the circularity potential of products and fostering circular design. You've been with Siemens over 20 years. That is amazing. Leading R&D and innovation efforts, forging ecosystem partnerships with academia and startups. So you really have the right mindset to talk about circularity and data.
Thank you.
Next on stage, Pascal Köhler from IBM Pabst, where he is Director of Business Innovation and Marketing. You've been 5 years with IBM Pabst, where you lead the circular initiatives. Over 10 years of experience in innovation across different industries, you're collaborating with customers to develop and implement circular business models. That's the aim of this conference, to look at the business model side of this whole exercise. And you see digitalization as a key enabler for making circular business models work. Perfect to have you here. Last, definitely not least, Tilman Wahle. Now with Qantas, 7 years with Systemic, where he is, Qantas now the chemicals and industrials lead. You were previously at Systemic, where you founded and led the Battery Pass Consortium and developed a guidance for industry to make data available for the circular economy. So I think we have the right people on stage. Very warm applause for them. And then let's get started. Yeah, digital product passports, they were just named before as one of the solutions to really get the systemic circular transition going. When we are working with companies, with SMEs, in our work we realize sometimes that people don't really know why they want or why we want digital product passports. In the end, these passports are a structured collection of product-related data. And, of course, we want to access that information to facilitate this circular, well, to push products or materials through the cycle. But the thing is, what is most often overlooked, we are looking already at this technical fix that brings all these data together, and we don't look at the point, what are these data? Why do we need this data? Why do we want these data? And this is what I want to discuss with you today. We have this in three sections, and the first will go to why do we actually need the data. But before that, I want to start a quick round with each one of you in one sentence. What is the biggest opportunity you see in using this data? If you want to really put it to the point, what would it be for you, Caroline?
Through the data, I think we can better understand what is really the value of the product at a certain point of time, and then make it valuable for the customer and develop new business model. This is the very, very last value of it. Pascal, for you?
Yeah, we have a lot of R&D data and production data, but we are lacking the data from the use phase. So really we have products in the field, but we don't know how they operate. This is something I see will unlock new opportunities, new business models, if we have the data and see what kind of conditions our products see in the field.
Tilman, from your perspective.
I would say, besides all the individual data points, which can support very specific and sometimes not even quite known yet business models and applications, what strikes me the most fascinating, especially in today's day and age, is the bridge between the physical and the digital, where if every product by law has to have a QR code or an NFC chip or a harmonized identifier, this brings the data layer on products at scale, not just because one manufacturer wants it or two, but because the entire economy is bound to have it. That could give us the access to augmented reality and AI applications, product related, that really could be a breakthrough in the entire field.
Yeah, it's really cool that you're already linking the data with the technologies where we might get them from. And then going back to you, Pascal, you just briefly highlighted which data we need. Can you go a little bit deeper and also maybe pinpoint those technologies that we have already in place to generate these data?
Yeah, we have the traditional ERP systems, which everybody's suffering in a way. We all know them. But for the use phase, we definitely need how our products are operated. We are a builder of fans and motors, and we have products which go sometimes just with a fixed speed. If we know this kind of information and feed it back to our R&D, we can think about our strategies to reduce or to rethink how we build the products. Maybe we do not need so much aluminium and stuff like that. So this is something we are currently participating in projects where we use this kind of asset administration Shelly to collect data from different assets. Now we have to share it between all the partners in the value chain that everybody gets access, and then also finding together business models in the end for the end customer.
Caroline, how do you look at Siemens at this point, the data you need and the technologies together?
So there are different, I think there are different kind of data coming from the different phases of the product lifecycle, starting with the design phase. We have in the engineering phase all the data coming in our case from Team Center, where we are gathering all engineering and all product related data. And then we are using them to design new products and to make simulation, developing digital twins out of them, and then also using them to optimize the manufacturing phase. For us, the life of the product ends at the gate when they leave the manufacturing phase. Afterwards, as a black hole, we don't really know what our customers are doing with our products. And this is really a challenge. We have a lot of connected products with industrial age. We also, in the field of mobility, maybe there was a panel this morning with one of my colleagues from Siemens Mobility. We have maintenance system like Radiant. We have a lot of data gathered by IoT sensors. So in the use phase, we could gather a lot of data, but we don't own them. They are owned by our customers, so we cannot make value of them. At the end of life, it could help if we share the data we have about the engineering phase and the development phase, the design phase, with dismantler or with recycler, so that they know what they have to do with the product, how we can best separate them. But they are not shared at the moment because, so we are developing, we have heard that also, we are developing end-of-life instruction so that we can share some maybe not all the information about the product. I guess we are agreeing to the ownership, but at least information concerning how to separate different parts and how to recover the most of the value, mainly at the moment recycling.
So the point you're making is we have the technologies available, because many of these technologies for predictive maintenance, you know, the monitoring and such, they're sort of what you classically would describe as industry 4.0 technologies, right? So you are saying these technologies are there. It's just a question of accessing the data that they generate.
Yeah, it depends on the kind of product. Not all products have sensors and are collecting data. And the question is also, which kind of data do we need? And how are they structured and labeled? Because we need to be able to analyze them. But there are a lot of products that so far are not equipped with sensors. And maybe in the future, if it makes sense, we should think about equipping them with sensors. But it's only via direct connection with the end customers and understanding what is the use case, what are they doing with our product in the use case, that we can really know which kind of signal should be recorded and how to make value also of this information.
Yeah, okay. Pascal, the collection and sharing of real-time product data can bring some challenges, some risks with them. How do you look at that?
Yeah, this is my wish before I go in pension, definitely that we get that live data. I think everybody is now building up their own digital twin, which is nice, but still having all the data, which is not in the same way structured, it's not cleaned up. And if we sometimes look into our own systems, if we look at our products, bill of materials, how different components are named, I think we have a lot of data graves there. So this is step one for everybody to clean their own house and then sharing that then also in the value chain. And give me the second part of the question again.
Is there a risk for you as a manufacturer? I mean, yeah. You were talking about that before as well, for you, material composition, things like that. Is that something you're concerned about, that you could be taken against you at some point?
So we have a customer in the room, company Gündner. So if we share with them our bill of material and they have multi-sourced suppliers, we are not the only one they source. This might raise challenges for us in price discussions or other topics if we have full transparency in the value chain, what our fan and motors consist of. We have to balance there.
Mm-hmm. But Tilman and Caroline, you think there are these kind of data, trusted data sharing models that we can establish? I mean, Tilman, in the battery passport, you've been talking a lot about this, right?
Yeah, we have. So I think we need to differentiate between data that could be sensitive and data that cannot be sensitive, right? Like a publicly available carbon footprint, for example, is mandated to be public anyway. At the core of it, is should be non-sensitive, right? If it is a sensitive piece of data for a company, you probably need to look into how you accumulate that and how it is actually created so that you make it non-sensitive. Other data, like the REIT registration data on toxicity, for example, must be available also, right? So there's various data points that are just bound to be non-sensitive. There's others that could be sensitive, right? Material composition or even duration, lifetime, for example, could be quite sensitive data on performance. Now, the EU also considers this to a degree, the point of it to push into creating some transparency on the durability of products, right? We're talking about full circularity and increasing durability of products across the market. And the point is, if everybody has to do it, no matter where they come from, right? Important to keep in mind, this is a level playing field regulation, whether it's the US, a Chinese, German manufacturer, it doesn't matter. Everybody will have to comply with these baseline information. Then you create competition race to the top. It's meant to bring some information out of the dark. For many that are more sensitive and should be protected, there are established rules. The Asset Administration Shell has the protocols embedded. Catena X obviously has the connectors that have really robust data governance and security embedded. And there's no need for a blockchain or to wait for something. Right? This can be managed as it is managed a million times every day across industry today. So I think that's absolutely viable to do.
So it's an agreement on standardization, maybe what kind of data you want to make available, which you need to make available. Caroline, do you agree?
So we are also working on the battery pass. We have been involved in the Catena X, and I think there are always more initiatives like manufacturing with X, with semiconductor X, and so covering a lot of things. And I guess we need this standardization. We need protocols. We need also trust. We need data sovereignty. We need platform to share the data. But we need to make sure that nobody wants to get rid of his data or share them too much. So we need to understand at the moment it's not really clear which kind of data will be shared or have to be. I think it's a process. We are all trying to know what is the minimum and the maximum. I should share, I have to share. To be honest, everybody is looking at, I want to share as less as possible, but it should be okay to enable circular economy to come to life. As an administration, we are also working on that to understand there are some different submodules. In some submodule, you have the information from the design test, and now we need to understand how to collect this real-time data and which kind of data should be collected there. But it's a question of trust, so we need to understand how to share this data and the interfaces between the different systems, the platforms, and our own ERP system.
You've been talking a lot in the B2B context now. What about B2C? Which role can data access have there? Can it be a competitive advantage, our motto for this conference, to share specific kind of data to prove a point of our products have longevity or are easy to repair for customers? Pascal, I'm looking at you.
I'm just B2C. This is new business fields for us because we are solely B2B driven. Maybe there are some DIY people here who do stuff with our fans. But for them, it would be nice. Besides that, the information would be interesting for all the other players in the value chain. We talk a lot about recycling here. For me, recycling is really not that creative. We are really looking to preserve the value of the product, really to refurbish it, remanufacture it, whatever we call it, but really keep that value and then giving it a second life and a third life, and then we can talk about recycling. So really having products lasting for 20, 25 years and keeping it in the loop and not too early open the loop and recycle and then job is done. No, job is not done.
Yeah. Tim, when we were standing back there, I thought it was really interesting. There was something from the European Commission yesterday. We'll read this out quickly to you because it really brings this whole issue of aggregating data for a digital product passport new relevance, right?
Yeah, for sure. And particularly the question of certainty, right? We talked about, like, we're kind of all waiting for this to happen. Will not happen with all the anti-red tape mobilization happening across Europe for the better and the not so good reasons. And one concern that we had also in the Battery Pass Consortium, for example, was, is this all for nothing if some more traditionally leaning political forces decide to wipe off DPP? Like, Omnibus 8 will just drop this. It's been a lot of effort. Yesterday, the Commission published several comments and legal proposals on various elements of sustainability policy and one affecting the DPPs. And it's quite fascinating. They basically elevated even further and really, like, unequivocally make clear DPPs are here to stay, and even maybe more so than we thought. The text of the regulation draft reads, the digital product passports will become the main tool for disclosing and sharing product information across all new and revised product legislation. Introducing the eco-design regulation, DPP will serve as a digital container for digital labels, conformity documentation, instructions, manuals, safety information, technical documentation, and other information required under the various several new EU legal acts. A data carrier will be affixed, providing access to this information. As of yesterday, the latest legislative draft is very much not pulling back, quite the opposite. I think every company putting out a product knows the CE label, the conformity label. It's going to be superseded and embedded into DPP, and then a whole lot more is going to be surrounding that for B2B as well as B2C products. I think it's a starting point for a whole lot of stuff happening, including cutting red tape. It's really one container, it's in one place, so it can create huge amounts of efficiency gains and access business platforms at scale. Will turn out very different per product, right? The product regulations specify what data is in there. For batteries, it will be very different than for electronics, for fashion, for materials, whole different stories every time. But the principles remain the same. It's really the basis for product disclosure.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's cool because that's now getting us to the section where I want to talk about this. Can we think of, I mean, it's going to be regulatory compliance, so you got to do this, but can we think about it as creating business models from the data that we have to be collecting anywhere? And I'm coming back to some results from the Battery Pass project, which I found a little bit disappointing. You tried to assess the value for different actors in the value stream, and you basically found out downstream, it's fine. You can really see that it brings an added value to have this data transparency. But for the manufacturers, it was a little bit difficult to prove, right? And now you're sitting here next to two, so I challenge you. Would you rethink the statement, or would you argue that you still need these data and it's going to be interesting for manufacturers as well? What's going to be the added value? Tilman?
I think it's more of an indirect value that depends on the strategy of the company. With Qantas, obviously, as with Systemic before, I mean, an advisory function, right? Like, I don't produce a product. We support companies to make sense of this and do this efficiently and hopefully also to consider it as a business opportunity. And I mean, what we've been saying for 2 years, with more urgency now as the deadlines approach with battery passports, is think through how to actually use this as a tactical advantage. One of the leading battery manufacturers globally, I've been working with them on that. They consider this a huge opportunity for brand building. It's an Asian manufacturer, big surprise. They want to show their durability, performance, and brand. That's a branding story. They also give access to their customers, which are B2B, to get easier access to performance and testing data. So for them, it's a means to share the data to those that can make value. And so that's, I think, the channels that we need to think through how to build business relation, a user to craft business relationships rather than conventional sell and forget contracts, users to build longer term throughout lifetime relationships potentially.
Yeah. Pascal, monetize compliance in a way.
Yeah, I'm thinking if we have it, it would be a huge enabler for as-a-service business models in the value chain. So really changing the ownership for just pushing a product out. We are still the owner of the product, we as manufacturers, and this could be a huge opportunity because then we have really the motivation to build long-lasting products and take it back and not take it back end of life, maybe end of use. Maybe not after 20 years, but 10 years, make an upgrade in the field with new technology, new PCB, electronics, and then give it a second life. So I think individual players can think about as a service, but it has to be harmonized in the value chain with suppliers, manufacturers, and customers. So I think this could be a precondition for a boost for pushing this kind of as a service, which is in B2C very popular, but in B2B, everybody is a bit reluctant to use it. They see more risks than opportunities.
Caroline, what is this for you? I mean, we are working together on a project. Can you share some insights into what this data availability free from the use phase makes it so specifically interesting for you and what your learnings are from the first results from our joint project?
First of all, I would like to pick up on what you said. For us, to get real-time data will enrich our digital twin from our products, and through the availability of lifetime modeling, we can better evaluate the remaining performance and the remaining useful life of the products. So I think it gives a lot of stress, not only for us, but also for the customer, because at the moment, our products are sometimes on digital platform that we are not own. We are not the owner of, and they are sold without the guarantee we will give. Of course, they are cheaper, but the customer doesn't really know what is the quality of the product because it's a second-hand product. So if we would have product as a service business model with all these models behind and be able to calculate what is the remaining useful life and performance of the product, we will be able also to give guarantee on the quality of the product and also be able to specifically know what is the value of it, put a price tag on it. On the other side, I think it would boost the second-hand market because the customer would know I can rely on the information. So this is the first thing. And also at the moment, we don't know that much about how our products are used by our customer because we don't have the data. But our customer know the value of our product, and sometimes at the end of the first phase, if it's a short, we are very long-lasting product, high-quality product, and sometimes they can last 20, 30 years. And if the life cycle at the customer side is shorter, after 7 years they need to change something, they keep it, they don't sell it. But then when they want to reuse it, they develop their own test, and through these tests that are not suitable for the product, they break. So they generate waste, and we could avoid that if we have this bilateral relationship. We get the product back, we test it as it used to be tested after production, then it would avoid waste, develop more trust, and also this bilateral, closely tightened collaboration.
Yeah, I really like this point. I'm a firm believer of these data-driven business models, the performance business models. It makes so much sense. And I've been working on that topic. It was in the Industry 4.0 context. And now we are applying the same principles to the circular economy. Performance-driven business models make sense. When I'm trying to apply the same logic in the circularity context, I very often get this question, this is really difficult. This is some green demand that you are posing here. I just want to ask, well, basically all three of you, do we have maybe a difficulty just in the moment where we're applying a green label or a circular label on a business model that has been discussed as bringing new added value in the Industry 4.0 context, and now we find it more difficult? It's my impression. You can prove me wrong. Who wants to start?
Broadly, the zeitgeist isn't great for sustainability right now. I mean, you won't be surprised that I think that's not good and not correct. Nonetheless, the leading narratives by those that try to stick with what's been in the past, or maybe still it works, has been very successful in suggesting that, for example, climate action is expensive, which even today, even in Germany, is just blatantly wrong. Heat pumps in 95% of flats, you know, Fraunhofer's calculated this, save your money, full stop, as one example. I mean, there's many of them. And so I think partly it's a narrative, anything that where green or circular or sustainable is a fix to anything, people may instinctively think, ah, oh, it's expensive, I can't do this. And it's also coming from a compliance and regulatory side rather than an industry-driven boost, you know, big industrial push rather than a regulatory-driven initiative. And so that also has a tendency to sound more like red tape or cost, even though many regulations are quite the opposite of that. Without regulation, we wouldn't have an economy to begin with. So I think that's two factors that play into this. It's the perspective of where does it come from and who talks about it in the company, right? The legal counsel and governmental affairs and compliance or business innovation folks. So.
You're the business innovation folks, Pascal.
Yeah, but I cannot do it alone, so we have to do it together. We have a lot of commitment from our management to drive circularity, and what plays into our hand is having this digital twin, having this remote monitoring. All other parties in the company understand, oh, this works together. If I have a digital twin, then circularity is much easier, and we can do this. So it really, I'm repeating that story since 7 years at EBM Pabst, and it takes some time in SMEs. But now people understand if we have that, we can have a circular business model and improve even with the standard product business models where we apply certain strategies. This is a great start, but now we can continue and really harness the data we have and even improve them and have much more efficiency also in the value chain for us.
So we don't have to remove the label? That's your short answer.
We stick to our value and... Yeah, and we can make sense of all the digital technology we are developing also, digital twin technology.
Okay, fine. So we are really doing good in time. Are there any questions that you may want to ask the panel?
Think fast.
There's someone in the back. Oh, there's two.
Jörg Hefer, thank you for the elaboration. The question I have is, we talk about digital twin, and then if we talk about any type of object or system which is manufactured, energy goes in, matter goes in, information goes in. So would it be possible to protect a digital twin so that who wants to disclose information can disclose, and who does not want to? But that may offer an opportunity to widen the acceptance of the digital product passport.
So the question of which data do you share and which do you not share is vital, right? We talked about this in the beginning. And for those of you that have not spent years on this topic, the core of the requirements that the EU sets for the base is that there will be different data governance rules apply to different type of data and stakeholders. What I want to say is, with that is for battery passport, the being first ones that's defined. For example, there are three stakeholder groups that can access the data. There's data that will be publicly available. So, for example, CO2 data. That's non-critical, and every product and everybody that puts it on the market has to do it. Then there's B2G data, so governmental compliance data, and nobody can access that but the delegated parties that are, you know, government or authorized. So that's highly protected compliance data. And then there's the B2B data, and that's a bit more murky, where it's a matter of like who has a legitimate interest, as the law says, and then, you know, needs a role-based access and, you know, actual certificate to access it with the right passcodes and so on. And so the data, you know, some super available, some highly restricted, and some depends on the role you have. But the passports will come, and the economic operators that are responsible to put it into the market will have to share a degree of data and will be able to add further data voluntarily.
But then the question is, what's the discussion about if protective measures are already there? Yeah, so. No, so well, the concern, what's the concern?
So in terms of data and data
I think
privacy?
It's a question of trust.
Yeah.
To test this technology. But we have already, built some ecosystem like Estenium with Sigrin, where we share information concerning the product carbon footprint. I think it's evolving. There is some fear at the beginning for new technology, and there is also this cybersecurity aspect. Also, a lot of people are not trusting the infrastructure. This is part of the problem.
I think the gentleman in the back was first.
On that topic, will the data be equally available upstream and downstream? Think of social responsibility, right? Human rights. There was an issue with brands demanding to get data from suppliers, which have been used to address human rights aspects, but also to negotiate prices, right? So transparency was unequal in the value chain, which creates an issue if the buyer knows the supplier's calculation, but not vice versa. So will the digital product pass be equal across the value chain?
No idea.
That's a good question. Yeah. I think so. Basis, again, for data access is legally a legitimate interest. And I think we can all rest assured that before any data is disclosed for additional purposes like new business models, I mean, we all know this. What's like the first thing is IP protection is definitely an interest that's far above that. Just as like Kartellrecht was in English again.
Compliance.
Various compliance questions, like those will supersede an interest for additional value from that downstream. In that negotiation, B2B, who has a legitimate interest to access certain types of data, will play an important role and would also uphold in front of court. It's important to know the battery passport is established with the manufacturing of the product rather than along the value chain. The sharing back upwards is probably not typically happening. There's integrated companies that kind of are on both ends, right? Like many battery manufacturers have their recycling as well. Interesting conflict of interest with other battery recyclers potentially. That becomes legally quite complex when that could then be disclosed and when not. But I think that differs so much per product and per individual company constellation that we'll have to see when we get there, basically. For a T-shirt, far less complex, we'll also have a DPP. I think it's a much cleaner story than for a complex engineered product.
But if you change the type of business model, if you have product as a service, you don't have to share with your customers. Your problem because you get the product back. So.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, if you don't want to recycle it yourself, but actually, if you take care of all our strategies.
There's someone in the back?
Thanks, Patrick Hübscher. I have a question about the circular impact, because I get that one of the main motivations of DPP is to increase circularity. Is there any estimation about the effect of the DPP in terms of circularity, closing the circular gap, maybe also in comparison to other policy instruments that are a bit more price-related, recycling quota-related, and so on? Will that move the needle in terms of circularity?
Yeah, I think what we started really to gather the data for our product carbon footprint, and currently this is a manual job to provide it to our customers, but this is maybe with the product passport, this can get much more automatically. And this is also for me getting more and more also as a sourcing decisions also for our customers when they deliver their systems to the customer. What is the product carbon footprint? So for me, this could be really a good data source, the DPP, really to have this embodied CO2 tag for every product available. And then we have also different buying decisions when do I buy a new product or a refurbished one, because we talk all the time about pricing, but then we have also the CO2 emissions. So I think this hopefully gets much more transparency in the market.
During Battery Pass, we modeled this and tried to find actual business models and how they work and validated them with industry. And a bunch we were able to quantify. Many we substantiated, but it was very hard to put numbers against. So we found like 12 that were, you know, everybody said, oh, this works. One that was the most apparent was cutting costs in assessing state of health of batteries during lifetime. And that starts actually just with the first resale of an electric car. If you have poor data, you pay less, right? It's the market of lemons theory, economics. And that applies here too, to the degree like the Munich startup Twice. They actually have a, I think with Munich Re or with Allianz, a business model where they provide better data to increase the resale value of electric cars. The same principle applies, right? So this works. Another one is on recycling. If you have better data on what's contained in the product, you can optimize your processes. You can potentially talk about automated disassembly if you know they have the blueprints in a machine-readable format. So that really, we can summarize this, lowers transaction costs, right? And optimizes at every state of the lifetime product value. So it's not revolutionary that it suddenly it's like 10 times more, but if a battery recycler, we found around 10% cutting costs at the process, that's substantial. It slices away at each step, for example.
There was one more question, and then I think we're going
to... In addition, I would say that it's complementary measures for the recycling targets, because through our interaction with a recycler, they are really waiting for the DPP, because they get some targets from the European Union It's really a tricky business, actually, because they have to mix a different stream of product to reach their targets. And it's not an easy business. So, and I think getting more information from the producer will help them to reach these targets. And also, we have not talking about the design phase. Getting this data back to the for us as a manufacturer, we can improve the design of our product. At the moment, we don't know, and if we knew what our customer do with our product, we would change the design right away because we know this part is going to break if we do this kind of test, and then we can have a kind of modularity and just separate it. So I think also improving the design for recycling or for dismantling will help also to improve it or to reach this target.
Finally. Just kidding. What are the conversations that are being had about the environmental impact of the data storage? And are there any new insights that you could share with us? Of course, this takes up a lot of capacity and potentially blockchain and, you know, complex systems in terms of data security. So, what are your thoughts on that?
So there's a Fraunhofer study that tried this on electric phones and modeled the energy consumption of AWS clouds, for example, and Oracle clouds and so on, and made hypotheses about how many queries would be taken on each DPP. And they found it was like absolutely negligible, like a fraction of anything that you would normally measure throughout the lifetime. And that was on phones. I think just for relative size, we're talking about for batteries as one of the more complex DPPs, about 100 data points. And that's like for anybody working on data, that's really trivial, right? Automotive or engineering companies, they talk about transferring terabytes of data like daily. Orders of magnitude, rather, I think, irrelevant. If it was to be used live for queries every day, that could create traffic. Mm-hmm. But I think, that's quite a hypothetical. That's unlikely to happen, I think.
Okay. So then let's close this. I mean, you're reading out from the new developments on the European level. Is this the kind of breakthrough that we have now? Or are there any other requirements on the technological side, on the cultural side, for us in Germany sharing data, bringing the C perspective in BNC? What's your thoughts on that? Caroline, you want to start?
We need more trust in this technology because we need this data, so we need to share them. So, of course, we need to make some progress on the technology side, but there are a lot of things already there. I think we need to make some exploration phase and look at what is suitable for us and which kind of data we really need and build on that.
Pascal.
Yeah, regulation is always nice, but we have to do our homework, so we can't wait all the time for regulations. So I think we have to prepare. We have to do our pilot projects, really gather the data and the value chain. That also increases the trust, see what it's not that dangerous if I use that data point and so on. So I think this really having projects together, not having data set points for everybody, but really sharing it, and this can just come through industrial projects together.
Cool. Thank you. Firman, final word.
Yeah, I'll concede with that. It's get going. Try it out. Especially now that its compliance is still a little bit ways away. It's not something that you kind of have to force through. And get ready as a company to assess like how is the company affected, what's opportunities, and do the first pilots and get going.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for listening. We invite you to find the competitive edge in your data. And this, we thank our panel. We release you for lunch. Enjoy.
This was another episode in our series about the Circular Republic Festival 2025. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. Let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.